listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross.
This episode, we have great interviews with
the lead sponsors of DC's new Paid Leave Act, which has gotten a lot of national attention. So I think that's going to be a fantastic conversation to have. It's a really important issue that will help a lot of people in the district.
And a huge anti-poverty policy. We also are going to have an overview from our new criminal justice correspondent. We now have a criminal justice correspondent. How cool are we? Todd Cox, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a former public defender, is going to be with us to talk about last week's very important legislation introduced in the Senate, being hailed as historic criminal justice reform legislation. He will give us an overview of what's in the bill, what's not in the bill, as well as talk a little bit about the school-to-prison pipeline.
And we have another great installment of the Weekly Ish Worst Alan Pike.
Oh, the best.
This one, I think, is going to be particularly entertaining for fans of this segment.
That's right. Stick around for the end because we have an extra special deluxe segment of the Weekly Worst. There are actually four stories.
Dun, dun,
spoiler.
Dun.
But first, Talk Poverty Radio is excited to welcome our new criminal justice correspondent, Todd Cox. Thanks so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio, Todd.
Thank you, Rebecca. Glad to be here.
So, Todd, get us started with an understanding of what's in this bill. There's been a lot of discussion of, yay, we finally have legislation after months and months and months of talk and talk and excitement and bipartisan love fests. What's actually in this bill?
Sure. Well, let me start by saying that this is a tremendous, as you mentioned before, a tremendous achievement. To have a bipartisan piece of legislation. It's not comprehensive, but a significant piece of legislation that really targets the main drivers of over-incarceration and over-criminalization of the stakeholders that I'm committed to working to help, which are poor folks and people of color and communities, and folks, frankly, that should not have perhaps been in the system in the first place. I think in the bill, I'm going to just give you some highlights. It starts, obviously, with focusing on mandatory minimums. There was no proposal, there's not yet been a proposal that absolutely gets rid of mandatory minimums. But this bill is significant in how it looks at mandatory minimums, trying to focus them and target them on folks that really should be punished in this way, who should be in prison for these long sentences. It first expands the existing safety valve, which is a system that judges can use to assign punishment, assigned sentences. It expands the opportunity for folks to avoid mandatory minimums and gives judges new discretion to exempt a significant number of individuals convicted of nonviolent drug offenses from mandatory minimums. It makes the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 retroactive. Now, that the FSA trimmed back unfair and racially disparate disparities between crack and powder cocaine. That was a large issue, as we know, a while back. After the FSA, the U.S. Sentencing Commission did their job in making sure the guidelines reflected it and made those guidelines retroactive, but the FSA didn't actually alter the sentences. This would make the FSA retroactive and really provide relief for upwards of 6,000 current prisoners and allow them to petition for sentencing reductions based on the FSA's new rebalancing. It provides sentence reductions for early release for prisoners who successfully take part in rehabilitation programs. It limits application of solitary confinement to juveniles in federal custody, and that's a very important piece to this. I think that we know now through studies we've known for many years, but particularly this, the understanding has been heightened that juveniles should be treated differently in our system. Brain development, behavior, all of those things are factors in the activities and the actions they take, and we really should treat them different than adults, and I think this reflects that. For nonviolent juveniles tried as juveniles in federal court, the bill also provides for sealing and expungement of criminal records, so which is significant. Again, as we all know, and as your One Strike report points out, you know, one in three folks have criminal records. For juveniles, that's a particularly large problem, and for everyone, it creates barriers to employment, education, and the like, and this would provide opportunities for folks to not have those barriers and not not face those barriers. So that's huge. And finally, it requires the Attorney General to develop a process for individuals to challenge errant background check information if they're going through a background check. And that's, again, significant. We know, it's well known, that criminal record information is often wrong. Certainly, arrest records are in existence or on paper that shouldn't be. And the FBI maintains this database, and that's what everyone looks to. One story I will tell you is that the EEOC is litigating a case that involves this issue. Someone was denied an employment opportunity through an errant criminal record. And, the EEOC is litigating the adverse employment decision made pursuant to that. So it's a significant issue. And it's important that this bill provides an opportunity for people to challenge errors in their records. Couple things to highlight. I think that a lot of the focus has been on sentencing correctly and on sort of prison reform, making sure people are rehabilitated. I think that the bill, by having that sealing piece as well as the criminal records piece, really focuses a lot on the back end, truly back end. I think it's great to prepare folks to reenter society, give them rehabilitative services and drug treatment. But if you don't reduce those barriers or eliminate unnecessary barriers, folks are just going to cycle back into the system. So this bill really tries to address a lot of that.
Well, and you mentioned that the bill is not comprehensive. I think a lot of the media coverage has referred to this as comprehensive criminal justice reform legislation. Mm-hmm. What makes it not comprehensive? What's not in the bill that you would like to see?
Well, I think, as I said before, nothing is perfect. And I think we should look at criminal justice reform as a process. In the states, that's certainly how it progressed. You had one landmark bill that sort of set everything starting, and I think that I think we can look at it this way. There is a bill called the Fair Chance Act, which focuses on what is commonly called banning the box. And I think that is a back-end reform measure that's not in this bill, put forward by Senators Booker and Johnson. It's a bipartisan, bicameral piece of legislation. How often does that happen in Congress?
Spoiler alert, never.
Never.
These days, it seems.
That is correct. This is a piece of legislation that hopefully will move right along with this larger piece of legislation. And, just to explain what ban the box is, we're not saying that you're eliminating the opportunity for employers to learn about criminal records. What you're doing is that you're delaying the inquiry until a conditional offer is made. Now, what does that do? That gives the employer and the employee to get to know each other. It gives the employer the opportunity to determine that the person's qualified without the bias that may attach to having a criminal record. At the time the person asks the question, the employer can then consider the information, and we know from the EEOC and certainly Title VII, there's some steps that employers should take, making sure that their decision is fair and equitable. Some of those steps include making sure that they're considering how long ago the crime or the offense occurred, making sure that there's a real nexus or connection between the job the person's applying for as well as the offense. And then evaluating how severe the offense is. The employer can still do all those things, in fact, are required to do it. And we also encourage them to engage in an iterative process with a candidate to make sure that everyone's comfortable and the person has an opportunity to explain what happened in their past. But what banning the box would do would really allow employers both to learn about the criminal record but also get to know the person and again, in a bias-free format.
And ban the box policies are something that we've seen really proliferate across the United States. We've seen cities pick these policies up and pass them into law. We've seen states adopt them. I've actually lost count at this point. I used to have a great talking point about how we had 70 cities and 13 states. That's way out of date at this point because it's ban the box has been so in vogue and in such a wonderful way. But what this legislation does, as you're describing it, is it goes farther than just delaying that question, right? It actually sets out criteria that employers must follow, and this legislation would apply to federal contractors and federal employees.
That's right. I mean, I should say it's limited to the federal workforce, so it's federal agencies, but also significantly federal contractors. And while it doesn't lay out, as I mentioned before, the sort of EEOC guidelines, that should be every employer should know that's a requirement. Title VII is on the books. It's Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Nothing in this piece of legislation trumps that or re- re- relieves an employer's obligation to comply with that. What this does is just, frankly, give the employer an opportunity not to have that problem because they will have made a smart, educated employment decision without having to worry about knowing up front that the person has a criminal record. And then once they learn, obviously, they should take the steps I described before. The other thing you alluded to was how much this really has taken off in the country, and that's absolutely right. But we're seeing a lot of companies taking the steps voluntarily. Koch Industries, Walmart, Target, some major companies, and small businesses are learning that they can both have a risk-free, safe work environment, but also afford someone a second chance. And it's good business, particularly in communities where the workforce, frankly, are with people who have criminal records, and employers know they need to have folks they can hire.
So does the bill go far enough, in your opinion?
I mean, I think,
And I'm speaking about the bipartisan criminal justice reform bill, not the Fair Chance bill.
Sure. I mean, I think there are, no bill is perfect. To be truly comprehensive, I think, we would have liked to see probably more of the back end stuff, maybe more front end opportunities for for reform. Some would critique and criticize that there are some additional mandatory minimums in the bill. But I think, this is an important vehicle. I think that to quote one of my bipartisan partners in this, there are always opportunities in a piece of legislation to attach anchors, to attach things that might put the bill at risk. And I don't think we can afford that. We need to have a bill that's while not perfect, is a focused vehicle that we can use to actually further the conversation. And I mean actually pass, but also further the larger conversation and have an opportunity for some real progress here. And I also want to say that, as I said before, it's a process. And part of that process, I think, is everyone learning to trust each other, both, I think, in the Senate, the House, in a bipartisan way, that people are coming to this with an honest desire to see some reform. And I think that takes time. This is a first very important step, and I think it's a good piece of legislation. Hopefully we'll get the Fair Chance Act. Hopefully we'll see some opportunities for policing reform. That's something that CAP had called for a while ago, making sure that folks have an opportunity to really repair the relationships between police and local communities, which frankly, I think, gave rise to this current interest in criminal justice reform. We want to see all of that. And I think this is an opportunity to really have a way to begin that conversation in earnest. Now, there are bills pending in the Senate and the House, I think, to address some of these issues.
So give us a sense of sort of moving between now and the coming months, right? We don't have that many days left in the legislative calendar in this session. Is there a chance that this bill is going to move? Do we think that this is actually going to become law? What happens from here with this bill?
Sure. Well, I'll avoid singing "I'm Just a Bill."
Why? That would be great.
I will avoid doing that. But I think the way forward in the Senate is a bit clearer than the House. Okay, so in the Senate, I think we have this gang of six or seven that you described, and actually more who actually joined the bill, who I think are committed to this deal, committed to making sure this happens. And I think while we don't have any firm dates, I think folks are very interested. Certainly, I think I'm not speaking out of turn to say Chairman Grassley is interested in moving this piece of legislation. So I'm optimistic, frankly, that we can see some activity in the Senate. I'm optimistic that this can get to the floor and voted on. And I'm hopeful that we'll have a strong bipartisan vote. Moving to the House, it's a lot less sure, I think, largely because, we're not sure about the leadership situation. We have, I think, committed folks both on the right and the left in the House who have made it clear they want to do criminal justice reform. We have the chair and the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Representative Goodlatte and Representative Conyers, who've made it clear they want to do criminal justice reform. But nothing's dropped yet. We're hopeful that something soon will drop, and we're hopeful that the Senate vehicle will move over there and that we can actually have some conversations and move the ball forward. But as you point out, time is tight. So this has got to be a priority for everyone. And I'm hopeful that it will be.
Well, on a final note, another topic that's been in the news quite a lot, but especially within the last week because of a particularly horrific story that broke, is the school-to-prison pipeline. Mm. And the particular story that I'm referring to is a very, very young African-American boy was having a staring contest with a very, very young white girl. And they were students. They were friends. Mm-hmm. And this actually resulted in him being taken away. And tell us this story and whether this is an exception or the rule.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry to say, well, first, the story, as I'm familiar with it, is an African-American boy in a staring contest with a white girl.
And how old were they?
Oh, they were, I don't really know exactly, but I think they were certainly young elementary school age. Let me put it this way, an age that when we were kids, and you're younger than me, but you know, I think we're both in the same boat here, where you would not be expelled, and that's what happened with this young man. And I feel that, unfortunately, because we are in this over-criminalization world where we are criminalizing activity. You have the young man in Texas who was not just turned away, but again, expelled, taken into custody for bringing what someone thought was a bomb to school. It turned out it was a clock, right? And so, you know, I think that in this particular situation, and I think for a lot of folks of color, I think you need to sort of, it gives you chills, right? Young children. I have a pre-K daughter, a young African-American child, very energetic. You know, I'm hoping that her energy won't be misinterpreted as criminal activity. I think that, you know, that's as a parent, these are things that you don't want to ever experience with your child. In this particular situation, he was expelled. Parents, I think, have sued, and they're going to the lawsuit was dismissed, and they're going to appeal. But I think these are the kinds of things that potentially put a child on the path to unfortunately be in the criminal justice system. It may sound ridiculous, but and from my own experience as a public defender, I didn't do trial work, but certainly in our systemic work, we represented kids sort of in a systemic way who were being detained at Oak Hill for some very serious crimes, but also kids who may have run afoul of the law early in their lives. And it just so happened in their school, the school security was a Metropolitan Police officer. And in that situation, a school fight, what I was involved in on a regular basis as a very young child, would turn into an assault, a battery, and you get taken away to jail. And we know that even being detained in jail for any amount of time can really have an incredible impact on your future and on your prospects, both positively in terms of not having them, but also your prospects for actually going deeper in the criminal justice system. So I think we need to be careful about how we criminalize school behavior, criminalize children in the name of safety. And I think that we also need to be careful how we racialize things, whether it's intended or not. We don't want a situation where we are sort of lifting up in some ways a 21st century version of To Kill a Mockingbird, where we're criminalizing this behavior just perpetrated by, quote-unquote, perpetrated by African-Americans. And I just, as I said before, it gives you chills as a parent, as a human being. You don't need to be a parent to see how aberrant this kind of reaction is.
Todd Cox is a former public defender. He is currently a senior fellow here at the Center for American Progress, focusing on criminal justice reform. We've now anointed him our criminal justice correspondent for Talk Poverty Radio, which means we will be having you back. Thank you so much for joining the show, and looking forward to seeing where this legislation goes.
Thank you, Rebecca. Appreciate it.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross.
And I'm Rebecca Vallis. Nearly every worker will experience a caregiving dilemma at some point in their working lives, whether to care for an aging or ailing parent, to welcome a newborn baby or adopted child, or to tend to their own illness.
Despite the prevalence of these caregiving challenges, only 12% of all private sector workers have access to paid leave through their employers. In fact, the United States is the only developed nation in the world that does not provide paid family and medical leave.
In a historic move, D.C.'s City Council is working to change that for workers in the nation's capital, and just this week introduced a bill that's being hailed as the most generous paid leave legislation in the nation. To discuss this landmark bill, we are joined by a very special panel. We have two members of the D.C. City Council, as well as a leading advocate working on these issues, and we're going to let you guys introduce yourselves. So, council members, please tell us a little bit about who you are on council, and we're thrilled to have you.
Well, thank you very much. My name is David Grosso. I'm an at-large council member on the D.C. Council. I'm an independent, and I was elected about 2.5 years ago, and now I am the chair of the Committee on Education. So I come to this from a lot of different angles, but I think most importantly, it's about building strong families and the supports that children need to be successful in school.
So hello, I'm Melissa Silverman. I am an at-large council member as well, and I'm an independent as well. So you are with the two independent members of the D.C. Council. I'm one of the more recently elected members. I took office in January, and it's thrilling to be here at the Center for American Progress, HQ, because I come from the think tank world. Prior to coming to the council, I worked for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, one of their state-level groups, the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute.
And we're also joined by a great advocate here in D.C.
Hi, Sheena Widhowen, Advocacy Director with D.C. Employment Justice Center. The D.C. Employment Justice Center is a local nonprofit that represents low-wage workers in employment cases and organizes workers to advocate for worker laws. We've been around for 15 years working on behalf of workplace justice.
Well, this is a really exciting roundup of folks that we've got. We're really thrilled to have you here for this historic week. Just to kick it off, I mean, tell us a little bit about the bill. Almost every part-time and full-time employee in the nation's capital would be entitled to 16 weeks of paid family leave to care for themselves or their family. How is that going to work? And we'll start with you, Councilmember Grosso.
So a couple of years ago in the D.C. government, we began to explore how we can actually extend paid leave to workers in the city. And we started by talking about D.C. government employees, and we are actually able to get a bill passed that extended 8 weeks of paid leave to D.C. government employees. The idea was then, how do we then continue to develop this idea and get to where we are today, which is introducing a bill that would extend this to the private sector. So this will include all D.C. government workers, I mean, all workers in the District of Columbia. So D.C. government workers will continue to be included, and they'll extend to 16 weeks from 8 weeks. Other private sector employees will be engaged. Anyone who wants to get this coverage will be able to participate in this program. And the way it works is very simple. You have a fund that will be administered by the government. Employers and businesses around the city will pay a share into the fund, and then that fund will pay the employees for their time when they're caring for a loved one. So they might be out with a baby or out with a sick elderly parent or something of that nature, and they'll be able to pay out of that fund so that they aren't at a loose end. One important note about this, 16 weeks comes from the reality that in D.C. we have 16 weeks of protection for jobs. And so anybody who has to be out for any situation, their job will still be there for them 16 weeks later. What we're saying now is that it's time for us to begin to pay for this time off so people aren't stressed, so they don't have all sorts of loose ends and have to cobble together ways to make it by.
And let me add in, I thought Councilmember Grosso did a terrific job, as he always does, but of explaining how the bill works. to make a exclamation point on our Family Medical Leave Act, that you are allowed to take unpaid leave and your job is protected, but most workers can't afford it. They can't afford to do it, especially workers on the lower end of the income scale. And so what is really great about this bill is for folks making a moderate income. We live in a very expensive city. People won't have to make that choice between supporting their family and caring for their family.
So I want to bring you into this, Sheena. So you work on the advocacy side of things, and this is something, paid leave is something that progressives have been advocating for many years. Why do you think that the time was ripe for this sort of legislation, and what are people thinking about it, just working class people in the city?
Well, first of all, I think how this bill came about was a really a beautiful collaboration between our elected officials, the council people that are here with us today, and the community. So it was a table filled with folks who really work on the ground and brought the stories of working families to the table. And we had our council people really listening to those issues and trying to address them in a progressive way in this bill. So it's a great piece of legislation because of that. What's happening for working families, here in the district, like in many cities, wage disparities are at some of the highest rates that they've been in 35 years. That difference between the very bottom and the very top is just bigger and bigger. It's increasingly difficult to afford to live in this city. And what we're seeing is when people go to have their kids, they can't afford to stay here. And they're having to move farther and farther from their jobs. And I can't tell you, I've been 10 years now representing low-income folks. And I can't tell you how many times I've sat in front of a woman who's very, very pregnant. And in their most joyous time in their lives, they're crying and desperate because they've lost their income. Their employers have said, oh, you are too pregnant to work. Go home. And we'll see you when you can be back at work. Working people around this country do not have access to paid leave benefits. And what that means in real life, I'm a new mom myself. It breaks my heart to think about if I had to had come back to work when my baby was a newborn.
And of course, paid leave, and this is something we've talked about on the show before, is obviously critical to all workers, but particularly to lower income workers who are the least likely of all to have paid leave provided by their employers. And as you mentioned, birth of a child actually ends up being one of the most common precipitating factors of poverty in this country. So very much a universally positive policy, but also really an important anti-poverty policy. This legislation is being heralded as a national model. And what is it that makes this bill so much stronger than many of the ones that we've seen nationwide? What can other states and localities learn from what you guys are doing here? And we'll go to you, Councilman Grasso.
I think the key here is the universality of this bill. This is really covering as many people as we can possibly cover. And we're spreading the cost out as broadly as we can to lower the cost and the impact on businesses. So if you see somebody who has a question, well, is this going to cover me? The likely answer is yes. And I think that's really interesting. The other side of it is it's longer period than any other part, right? It's at 16 weeks. Many are much lower than that. And that really just recognizes the reality of this stuff, right? You can't just pretend like somebody doesn't need to be out for a longer period of time and just give them the shorter time. Finally, I'll just say, we're an interesting jurisdiction in and of itself. The District of Columbia has a limited role in home rule in itself, so we have our own legislative branch. We have our own mayor that's elected, but all of our bills do go through Congress. And so this will be an interesting test, I think, to see our bill will be reviewed and we'll see where it comes out. Hopefully, if we can get this bill through and when we actually implement it, it's going to have a huge impact on the city and it's going to be a broad impact.
And I do want to add in that the district was helped by Department of Labor grant that went to several jurisdictions, including, I think, Montana. And there's now a second round of grant funding. And what that allowed us to do is to work with researchers to really model how this legislation would work and bring that sort of good research and development to the public policy that we're creating. So our neighbor, Montgomery County, actually was a second round grant recipient. And as we've collaborated with Montgomery County and Prince George's County, who are our neighbors in Maryland on the minimum wage. Hopefully we can see some collaboration on paid family leave as well.
I think something that a lot of residents of Washington are get frustrated about is that there will be really great progressive ideas that the council comes up with, but as you mentioned, it has to go, you know, through review with Congress. You know, what are your thoughts on that process? Do you think that there's enough energy and momentum building around residents in the city that they will, you know, not try to obstruct this positive development?
Well, interesting, you know, Congress has in the past tended to only come after our policies when they're hot button issues that actually they can go back and get points for, whether it's from some big lobby group or from their own local jurisdictions. And so it's usually been abortion, drugs, guns. This would be an interesting question if family leave issues could be that big of a topic in this country. I mean, it would, I think, be a victory if we could elevate the conversation to the point where it is a, you know, nationally debated question on a regular basis on whether or not we're going to give people the time to really build strong families, to go out and engage with their loved ones when they need to be there. And that would change the whole debate. So I'm hoping that we begin to elevate this. There is a bill in Congress right now around this issue that could maybe get some real conversation. Too many times local jurisdictions are carrying the water for Congress, and especially in the past few years. So how do we get Congress to act again is, I think, a great question. And if D.C. can provoke that or get the conversation to a higher level, I think that would be a great victory.
And if our email is any indication, we were actually on another program earlier, and Councilmember Grasso and I both have email coming in from residents saying, you know, I was a new mom and I can't, you know, I didn't have leave, or I was lucky enough to have leave and I couldn't imagine going back, right back to work. This is an issue that I think that resonates with so many people. I don't have kids, but I have parents who are 75 and 80. And I think that's where paid leave is especially important, because you can't plan for, you know, you can't plan if something happens with your pregnancy, but with an older parent, you never know when something's going to happen. And then you need to take that leave immediately because you just don't know. I mean, my parents are healthy, but you just don't know when you could be an end-of-life situation. And that's so critical to give people the ability in that most important time to allow them to take a leave so that they can care for themselves or their family.
And of course, paid leave often gets thought of as sort of a policy for moms, right? But it is much more than that. It's also very, very important for people who might be dealing with their own illness or disability, mm-hmm. Perhaps on a shorter term basis. It's about 1 in 3 private sector employees in this country have access to employer provided disability insurance. This would enable those types of workers to take care of themselves, if I'm understanding the bill correctly.
That's the intent of the bill. I think this self care also is huge, you know, that people can go off and, you know, they had a car accident or something like that. They don't have to struggle with how the bills are paid right then, because they'll be able to tap into this fund. And you mentioned moms, and I think it would be important for me to note that a big inspiration for me on doing this legislation 2 years ago was fathers, too. And, you know, there's a group out there that was a huge help for me, ProMundo, which has a program in their group that's called Men Cares, which is trying to get more and more access for fathers into the family life. Why? Because the studies show around the world that the more that parents are involved with their children, men and women, are involved with their children, the better that child does in school, the better that child does engaging in the community and growing up to be a productive member of society. So this is really a motivating factor for me, is how can we find more spaces for men to get involved with their children and at a very young age help raise their children and be a part of the family. Leave like this is invaluable. If they could take 16 weeks, the mother could take 16 weeks, you could have, you know, potentially 8 or so months of care for a newborn child who gets to really bond with their family and grows up as a result with more confidence and, in fact, more passion around education.
The opposite of revolutionary globally, right? That's what other countries do and do it even better.
Right.
Than that,
I mean,
but revolutionary
we're just
here.
Trying to catch up with the rest of the world here.
Right. And now the bill is not without its critics. And the Washington Post, you know, put out a great story about the legislation recently, but it quoted the U.S. Chamber of Commerce saying that it would be an unprecedented
and make the District of Columbia dangerously uncompetitive because it's an employer-funded system. So as I understand it, a small percentage of each employee's paycheck would go into a general fund that would help support this program. So they're worried this is going to make D.C. businesses uncompetitive. Sheena, I'll start with you. How would you respond?
I mean, in fact, it makes businesses much more competitive, right? Because small businesses in particular who can't afford to already be providing paid leave programs, now they'll have the support that they need from a program like this to be able to provide their workers with paid leave. Retention. We're talking about competition in terms of being able to attract high-quality human capital, but also to be able to retain workers. The loyalty a worker feels when they've been able to take care of their families when they need to that employer and to come back is much more cost-effective than constantly losing your workers to something that's inevitable in each of our lives and having to pay for that turnover over and over. So in fact, I think it's a cost-saving measure. And we've seen this, you know, this type of program has been around in California for over 10 years. So you have a good amount of data and information from what's happened there. And businesses report generally positive to neutral outcomes. So very little sort of negative feedback after over 10 years of a program being in place.
Well, and a related concern that gets raised is that employers are worried that they're somehow going to have problems finding temporary help if their employees suddenly have access to needed paid leave. How do you respond to those types of concerns? Councilmember Silverman, let me start with you.
Sure. Well, I would echo the comments that were just made. And once again, being out of step, other company, private businesses are realizing that this is the way to go to attract workers. I'll point out that over the summer, Hilton just instituted a paid leave policy. And for exactly the reasons that were stated, that's going to retain workers as well as make people happier to work for Hilton. The U.S. Navy just instituted in July, I think, an 18-week parental leave program. So we need to make sure that we're in a competitive marketplace in the district. And I just spent the last night with a bunch of owners of restaurants in the city, and they were talking about how difficult it is to get workers. I think this is going to help us attract workers to our city because it's a family-friendly city. So I think it will be good for our economy.
And Councilmember Grasso.
Well, you mentioned the need for filling the gap. You know, right now they already have to do that, right? So that's one response is that there is protected job status. So when somebody goes out on leave, there already is a gap there that they're having to actually protect and fill that time with someone else doing the job. What they'll have here, though, is the opportunity to actually get the person paid who's off and save that money because it'll be a lower payment than what they might have done previously because the money that they're putting into the fund, that cost is spread out over the whole city. So that will allow them to have the money in their coffers at the business to be able to actually go and hire somebody more easily. Right now, it's kind of a jumbled mess the way they deal with it. So this will, I think, make it easier. But I do have to say, there are things that need to be worked out here. This is not a perfect bill by any means. We will work on it. I have been in direct communication with the D.C. Chamber of Commerce a lot in hopes that we can actually move forward to a more perfect bill. In the long run, though, it's important that we recognize the points why we're doing this, the principles behind this, and stick strong with those points.
And you said this is a partial solution to some of the growing disparities that that wage workers face in this city. And, you know, you mentioned the cost of living before. This is an increasingly expensive city to live in. So what sorts of, policies are you all working on in the future to ensure that this is just a first step in making sure that workers are protected and that families don't have to choose between caring for their family and going to work?
We've actually done a lot of stuff in D.C. already when it comes to minimum wage increases and things of that sort. There's still a long way to go, particularly in the area of housing. This is an area that the District of Columbia struggles with because as the markets change and as more and more people move here who are younger, who have more income, they're able to pay higher rents, and it's really driving people to the outskirts of the city. it's something that I think we have to address. I think we're working on that. We have a committee on housing now in the D.C. Council that's focusing on this on a regular basis, and I can let Councilmember Silverman expound on this a little bit since this is really in her bailiwick.
Sure. I sit on the housing committee, and certainly we have to make investments in affordable housing. Let me compliment Mayor Bowser, our mayor, who made a almost unprecedented investment in building new housing. We need to also make sure that people who are in affordable housing can stay there. But we face a big we face big gaps. We have an inequality gap. We have an achievement gap that Councilmember Grasso can speak to as our chair of our education committee. I think we also have an opportunity gap, and we need to close those gaps. And that's where I would say to our business community and the U.S. Chamber and the D.C. Chamber, you need to be partners with us. We want to partner with you because, as I said, when I was talking to our restaurant owners, they create a lot of jobs. And it's a great industry because it's an industry where you can work your way up and you don't need a lot of certifications in order to get started. But if you're making $10.50 an hour in this city, where can you live? You know, it's $21,000 a year. And what I said to these restaurant owners is partner with us, come to our hearings, talk about affordable housing, talk about the need to invest there. You know, there are other issues too that, you know, I think both Councilmember Grasso and I don't minimize that this is, you know, this will be a fund and employers will contribute. But in the end, what we want to do is create a healthy city in which we're going to have productive workers and families, and we know that leads actually to a better economy.
So another policy that we've talked a little bit about here, but it would be great to hear more about, is the push to raise the minimum wage. Now, there's word that this might be on next year's ballot, that it would be a push to raise the district's minimum wage to $15 an hour, sort of that number that we hear from Fight for 15 and workers who have been organizing and protesting across the country. Is the time right for raising the minimum wage in D.C.? And Sheena, I'll go to you.
Well, I'm going to say yes.
We kind of felt like you might.
I'm a workers' rights advocate. I mean, look, here's the deal, right? This country used to be a place where you could have an entry-level job and you could have a place to live, you could feed your family, you could have a family, and you could have a decent life. Now we have a situation where you have an entry-level job, you make minimum wage, and you can barely eat. You cannot live anywhere near those jobs, and you can't really fathom having children unless you all want to live well below the poverty line. Is that sustainable? No, not unless that is where we want our country to go. And I think that isn't the case. I think we all agree that we want all hardworking people to have at least to be able to meet their basic human needs and live with dignity.
I believe there was a study, right, that said that nowhere in the U.S. can someone making minimum wage afford a two-bedroom apartment.
That's right.
So it's definitely something that, you know, indicates that our wages aren't paying. But we'll kick it to two of our city council members, though, to weigh in on this.
This is a pretty ripe question. As you mentioned, you know, we did go through these debates extensively over the past 2 years at the council and put in a graduated minimum wage increase that's going to go, I think, to $12.50 an hour in the next couple of years. The question now is, does D.C. become part of the national discussion around $15 an hour? You know, again, this is a place where I wish the federal government would just step up to the plate and do their job. You know, we can't continue to pick away at this in local jurisdictions. It does have a huge impact on our city when we do this. I think it is hard for businesses to balance that out, and I have a lot of respect for that. But at the same time, the federal government's going to have to catch on here, and they're going to have to realize that around the country this is changing, and we should continue to put pressure on them to try to do what's right. And I think, you know, $15, is that the right answer? You know, I'm not even sure that's enough money in this time and age. And so where do we get to the real balance, and what does it entail? It can't just be about, you know, wage. It has to be about education and jobs and healthcare access. And all these things are part of the equation when it comes to your bottom line in your home. And so the federal government hasn't really stepped up enough, in my opinion, when it comes to minimum wage or housing. I think it's done better with healthcare in the past few years with the Affordable Care Act, but ultimately there's a bigger debate that needs to happen.
Councilmember Silverman, how's your optimism today?
Well, so just to be clear for listeners, because I know there are listeners from around the country listening. So this is a ballot initiative that has been certified by the Board of Elections. But now in the district, in order to get on the ballot, you have to collect signatures. And I've been involved in another ballot initiative, and you have to collect a lot of signatures. But I think it will happen, and I think it will get on the ballot, and I think it's going to pass. I do. Polling shows that people understand the basic fact that you cannot even live in this city. We're talking about $30,000 a year, basically, at $15 an hour, when the average cost of a one-bedroom apartment in this city is like $1,400 a month, and you have to eat. So by the time, and then, you know, what about kids? What about student loans? What about taking the metro every day, which is, I wish was a little more efficient, but it is expensive. Transportation is the number two cost for a family. So I do think if it makes a ballot, it will pass.
So we've talked about some good policies to enhance job quality. Sheena, what is your organization doing to make sure that more people are connected to career pathways that will hopefully result in this increased minimum wage and paid leave?
Well, you know, we're really focused on making sure, you know, part of our work is getting these laws passed and working with our wonderful council people here today to get these progressive policies passed. The other important piece of that is making sure that they're actually enforced so that these rights and benefits are fully realized. So we do a lot of work on the ground. As Councilman Grasso said, we've passed a lot of landmark legislation in this city, including paid sick days, including one of the strongest wage theft prevention laws in the country. And now it's about making that real and taking those laws for a test drive. So, you know, as we speak right now, a bunch of the workers that we organize are picketing outside of a restaurant in Northeast D.C. to help collect the unpaid wages of a worker. And these are the ways in which we're really using these laws. The other piece of our advocacy involves pushing, you know, city agencies to really do robust and proactive enforcement of these laws so that folks can actually make complaints about unpaid wages and then actually see those wages in a period of time less than 3 years long.
Well, and you mentioned that there's an action happening, a direct action happening as we speak. This happens to actually be a restaurant in my neighborhood. I would be remiss, given that I love that restaurant, if I actually didn't name it, because I think that people need to know and be conscious customers, you know, where they're actually taking their business. It's a place called Indigo. It's a phenomenal Indian restaurant. They need to be paying their workers just like everyone else, and I'm really glad that you guys are out there making sure that these phenomenal pieces of legislation are actually being enforced so that they aren't just theoretical, but they actually are making workers' lives better. I love the level of optimism we've got in this room. We'd love to have you guys back to talk about all the things once they've actually been passed. We can see what else is on the slate coming down the pike. But thank you.
Well, can we add in? So if you want to learn more about the legislation,
please, you should
go to, there is a campaign website, dcfamilyleave.org. I think Councilmember Grasso on his great website, which is DavidGrasso.org. I have a website too. I think it's AlyssaSilverman.org. It might be .com. I should remember those things. So if you want more information about the campaign, you should go there. I will say I thought the Washington Post had great coverage of the bill, and they have an explainer Q&A as well. So you can Google that. And then I would encourage D.C. residents and D.C. businesses. Yeah, this is a conversation that we are going to have about paid family leave. And so if you are supportive of the bill, certainly David and I would love to see you at council hearings or to submit testimony. If you have concerns about the bill, we'd love to hear from you too. So the best way to do that is to stay in touch with the campaign, and hopefully we'll have a hearing on the bill relatively soon.
And Sheena, where can folks find out more about the Employment Justice Center and what kinds of work you guys are doing on, and perhaps actually take a case if they're a non-practicing attorney or a practicing attorney in D.C., right, and want to do some pro bono work?
Thank you so much. We would love that. We're at dcejc.org, and the Paid Family Leave website, again, is dcpaidfamilyleave.org. And definitely, folks, if you're D.C. residents, get out, call your council people. This matters. 2 minutes of your time matters. It could make the difference between between passing a strong bill and not. They need your support. We do as well. This is something that benefits every single one of you. So please get on your phone, your email, your Twitter accounts, and let folks know you support this bill.
Council members Alyssa Silverman and David Grosso, and Advocacy Director of the Employment Justice Center, Sheena Wadhawan. Thank you guys so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And we're back with our weekly-ish installment of The Weekly Worst.
There's a lot of weeklies. Alan Pike from Think Progress is here with us. He's got, we hear, four stories instead of three, making this an extra special episode of The Weekly-ish Worst. Alan, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
All right. So
how do we thank you for four?
Yeah.
33% more than you bought last time, America.
New packaging, same great product.
All right. First up, six homeless Floridians are suing the city of Sarasota over a law banning people from sleeping outside. Sarasota has no publicly funded shelters for the homeless, and its lone Salvation Army shelter is consistently at or over capacity for most of the year. A lot of cities around the country have been doing things like this, criminalizing behavior that's just a part of being alive and surviving if you're homeless. And gradually, researchers start to come out indicating that it's actually a lot more expensive to use the cops and the hospitals and the official system to punish people for being homeless than it is to just give them homes. So the tide's starting to turn here, but there's this lawsuit in Sarasota trying to invalidate one of these sleeping outside bans.
Research has actually found, I'm going to drop knowledge, which is Tracy's favorite thing for me ever to do, that the average annual cost of jail and emergency room visits for a homeless person is more than $16,000 compared to $11,000 to provide them with housing and a social worker for the year. So penny-wise, pound foolishness going on in Sarasota. What's our next contender?
All right, next up, an Ohio judge is upholding the school suspension of a 12-year-old black boy whose only crime was staring at a white female classmate. The two were reportedly holding a staring contest at the time, and the suspended child said that his opponent was laughing during it. But the school decided that he had made her feel, quote, fearful, and suspended him for a day. And when the family sued, asking that the suspension be erased from their son's record, a judge named Patrick Dinkelacker rejected the lawsuit and upheld the suspension.
What was the judge's name?
I hope I'm saying it wrong, because it appears to be Dinkelacker.
Yeah, I read this story, which it's so appalling. One, you know, actually we have an event coming up soon on the preschool to prison pipeline.
Which we talked about earlier in this episode.
And
how, this is more and more common. But I think there's this weird element to this where when I first read the story, it's so common whenever there's a issue between a young black male and a white female student or citizen or anything right. throughout our entire nation's history. It's just criminal for a black man to look at a white woman. And that dynamic just, it feels very icky to me as I think the most appropriate word I'm allowed to say on air. I can say a lot off of air about this story, but it's also just, it really hurts. It's really painful to think about like kids just having fun and therefore being suspended because of it.
And of course the age of criminality in this particular scenario is very low. So from birth, if you are a black male, you can't look at a white infant.
Right.
Yeah, I gotta hope that this is the kind of thing where it's the adults in the situation
right.
behaving absurdly. But yeah, it's upsetting.
All right,
so what's number three?
Number three is the governor of Maine, Paul LePage.
Yes, excellent.
A favorite of the show.
Only good things can come from this.
Of the show.
He's our new friend, Walker, move over.
Paul LePage is reinstating a policy that's going to kick thousands more people off of food stamps for the crime of having saved up some money. Anyone with savings and checking account balances and other assets totaling more than $5,000 in value is going to lose eligibility for the food assistance program in Maine. Most other states have done away with these asset tests in their food stamp systems after Congress indicated in 2008 that punishing poor people for saving money isn't exactly consistent with the goals of the SNAP program.
Savings caps like this just piss me off so much, right? Because of the just insane hypocrisy. On the one hand, you've got policymakers telling low-income people who want to get ahead, you know, the way to get ahead is to save money. Work hard and save money. And on the other hand, they go, oh, sorry, not that much.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Too poor, you're bad.
I think our listeners are smart enough to agree with you, but I'm sure that there are some people that would think, well, you know, this makes sense. If they're making money, they don't need these benefits, right? You know, and it's really, we're not realizing that people, that the social safety net is insurance and it's helping you to escape poverty and that you need it until you're actually on a better footing, not temporarily on a better footing.
And the way to make sure that you actually end up on better footing in a sustainable way is to have those kinds of precautionary savings. So basically you're guaranteeing that once people manage to get their footing, they're going to have to be pushed right back into a crisis situation where they might need those assistance programs again because you didn't let them actually amass any level of savings.
You're basically requiring that they stand atop a trapdoor.
Right.
We could do a whole episode on this. We need to.
Let's. Yeah. We'll put that down in our next.
All right. And on a special bonus fourth nominee.
Ooh, yes. Yay. Fourth one. The one that made us break the rules.
A little bit. Little bit closer to home than the other three. Think Progress reporter Alan Pike.
I've heard of him.
Recently published a story about how little federal spending gets directed to children under a headline that implied that as a country we have to choose between funding programs for the old and funding programs for the young.
What was the headline?
It was something like...
Wait, you didn't come fully prepared with the headline?
How long have we known each other, Tracy? Of course I didn't. It was something like, why is spending on the elderly inviolate but spending on children is always on the chopping block? Which, as a number of readers pointed out to me in various fora, implies that there's a sort of a war between the generations here for scarce federal dollars, which isn't the case at all and wasn't the argument of the piece. The piece is about a report that details how the fact that we've left funding for children's programs subject to annual appropriations fights means that they are chronically underfunded. And part of what I was talking to the author of the report about is how could we adapt the rules and the structures that make it so hard for politicians to undermine Social Security and sort of retrofit them for programs for children so that they'll be exempt from our political nonsense. But I put it under a headline that played into some right-wing tropes in some ways that I should have been able to foresee and avoid, and I appreciate the feedback from everybody.
So, Tracy,
and we've changed the headline, which is why I couldn't remember.
Do you think that Alan is going to be upset with me if I vote for him, or do you think he's going to be more upset if I don't vote for him?
So I think he's going to be upset with both of us for voting.
So I know what you're
so
doing.
Tempting.
You know what I'm
like,
doing.
I think on face value, the other stories are inherently worse.
If y'all actually look me in the eyes and tell me I'm worse than Paul LePage. These friendships might be over.
Well, here's the thing.
I'm sorry,
I think
but
the other
on.
Stories are definitely worse, but you know better, Alan. And we need to hold part of Talk Party Radio is holding
people
the press accountable.
That's right.
For bad poverty reporting. So
for the record,
for
America, neither one of them knew that I had done this.
I just learned of this,
suggesting
and
this
I need
as a
to
joke,
hold you accountable.
And now you get to hear about it.
Which is why we got a bonus fourth story.
That's
so
my vote.
You can defend this up and down, Alan. The other stories may have actual policy impact in the immediate sense, but longer term, what this kind of false choice narrative seeds is budget cuts that force and pit one population of struggling people against the other while we, you know, box ourselves into a position where we can't put revenue on the table. So I'm sorry, Alan, you're part of the problem this
week.
I'm
going to start digging into this writer's background and find out what else is going on.
I know.
It's just concerning.
I've heard he's weirdly handsome.
Tracy,
like,
for
emphasis on weirdly. But.
For many episodes, Alan has been trying to get you to read his work. Be like,
that's
now you finally
have. I will.
That's the whole point.
All right. So, Alan, I guess you get to have a protest vote, but it's clear you're the weekly worst.
Unless you want to vote for yourself.
No, I'm voting for the Ohio judge who, forget the school administrators who think it's a good idea to suspend a 12-year-old kid for holding a staring contest with a white girl. The idea that there's a judge out there who thinks, no, you know what, this should be on your record. This one should follow you through the rest of your life. We should make sure that we keep tabs on this looks at white girls guy. I don't understand that mindset at all, and it's so damaging to the long-term prospects of the future generations of Black Americans who already have entirely too much to fight through.
Absolutely. And I think that you ended on on a good note, I think we don't disagree with anything that you said. I think that is absolutely the weekly worst, but we couldn't pass up a chance to poke at you, and hopefully you'll come back next week despite the ribbing.
So this week, Alan was the weekly worst-ish.
There
is basically
go.
What we've concluded. On that note, thank you, Alan, for coming here and offering yourself up as a sacrifice. We appreciated it. We enjoyed it. How can we ever have so much fun again? And we'll see you next week.
Maybe.
All right.
Can get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handle it. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food, the health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom, freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?
You're listening to We Act Radio, WPWC 1480 AM. Visit us online at weactradio.com.